Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. They say you can judge the health of a community by the health of the arts within it. And if that's the case, then Prodigal's community in Winston-Salem is thriving. They're harnessing the power of art to lead clean and sober lives. And then Winston-Salem native Sarah Siskin still marvels at the transformative power of music years after writing her first songs for Alison Krauss. From her teenaged WFDD concerts with Paul Brown and Doc Watson, Sarah's moved on to World Cafe with David Dye, and most recently, NPR's Mountain Stage. Today, fresh off the road with Bonnie Raitt, Sarah's here to share. We'll wrap things up today with more great music. First, it's a hop, skip, and a jump to Boone and an Appalachian Summer Festival. Then we're back in the Triad and an Eastern Music Festival chat with artistic director, legendary conductor Gerard Schwartz. His baton is poised for the downbeat next after this news. Diana Greene makes multimedia stories that explore our sense of identity, place, and memory. She's long been fascinated with both the everyday and the intimate truths that we often keep hidden within ourselves. Chip Bristol is a chaplain at Prodigal's Community, and he's looking for ways to blend the creative with the spiritual in the context of 12-step living, his own writing, and painting. The traveling portrait and essay exhibit Finding Home, Portraits of Courage, has brought Diana and Chip together to empower the men recovering from addiction at Prodigal's Community to share their intimate truths and to support their decisions to live clean and sober lives. The exhibition opens Monday afternoon, July 8th at 5:30 at the Winston-Salem Central Library. How did this particular collaboration begin?
In August of last summer, I got a letter in the mail that said, "Dear artist, I will not write you again." And I right away was captivated. And it was a letter from Chip inviting artists in the community to teach creative workshops to the men at Prodigal's Community, a place I didn't know about at all. And I thought, for sure I will, because what he said in his letter was he was interested in having the men explore their inner landscape, which is exactly my mission as an artist, is to explore my inner landscape. And I believe that's ultimately what interests me. So I was very excited to come and share that with people who are in a state of healing and in a state of identity crisis on some level. And it was a blast. I worked through September with a group of men, and they did phenomenal work, really open to the process. And Chip and I had a great time talking. We laughed and we talked about theology and we talked about the men, and we just wanted to continue. And this idea of a book and an exhibition then came later.
Right. Well, I have a thing, first of all, for black and white photography, good black and white. My brother was a photographer and always had pictures of Ansel Adams' work, and I just loved it. And when I saw Diana's work, I fell in love with her and her soul as well as her artistry. And I've always wanted to blend words with pictures with regard to recovery, because it's all about storytelling. And recovery, in its essence, is finding out your story. Step two is to accept your story. And the third is when you start telling your story. And I mean really telling, not the Hallmark card version. I mean the story. And when you do that, it's magical. And I wanted to do that, but then I wanted to get these faces. The faces of people in recovery are priceless because they have a story. These people have not gotten here through Botox. These people have gone through a lot, and it's all on their face. And I knew that Diana could capture it. So what I wanted to do, and I went to her and said, what if I got them to tell their story and we took something of it, and then you capture their face? And that's really what led to this book, which is called Finding Home, Portraits of Courage.
It's a great title, by the way. Who came up with the title, and what does it mean to you?
Everything belongs to both of us, but we work at Prodigal's Community, which is based upon it's a faith-based community, and the prodigal son's story is about somebody who wandered away from home and came home and found home. And so it's very in keeping with Prodigal's that this is about finding home, but that's what recovery, actually, that's what being human is all about. If we are truly finding home, and everybody's looking for home, from Dorothy and Ruby Slippers to everyone else, we're all searching for home. And the sad thing is some people never find it. The good news is I'm working with some people that are finding it, but it takes courage. And that's why the title is what it is.
At essence here, we're talking about this idea of collaborative portraiture from your end, from the artistic contributions you're making, Diana. What is collaborative portraiture? How does it work?
Well, I'd never worked quite this way, and it was fascinating. It was really fascinating because initially I would listen to these remarkable interview conversations between Chip, who is also their daily counselor, and these men, and I would be in the room photographing them completely silent, listening. And then I would go with the man and take a photograph based on a story, something that we heard that they were speaking about. Well, as it evolved, it seemed that Chip really needed to come along for the photographing because he was so connected to them that he could keep them in that space. So let's say, for example, one of the men was talking about enjoying the rain, being sober and enjoying the weather, just the thrill of being alive for that small event. We went outside in the rain, and he would continue to talk to the brother, as they're called, about that moment. And so when I was able to take the picture, we could stay there. So I think the story really is encapsulated in this split second that I've been able to take this photograph, because the three of us were making it together. It was, oh, just such an interesting combination of intention.
What sort of feedback have you been getting from the residents at Prodigals Community?
They have shown themselves to be everyone I knew they were, which are little boys, and they're being affirmed. I grew up, obviously, in the shadows of great pieces of literature, and one title has always haunted me, which is The Invisible Man. And the idea that there are people walking around this world, and I work with them now, who were at one time invisible. Because of this project, because of the dignity that they find at Prodigals, but also because of Diana's work, they're not invisible anymore. Their story is out and held up and celebrated. And to look at the way they respond is great. Let me give you an example. One person didn't want to participate, and that was fine. It was an optional thing. Until all of a sudden, he saw the works of other people, and he read the words of other people, and he said, well, actually, I would like to be a part of it, which was just a great moment because suddenly he realized that this was a great project and a wonderful thing to be a part of. And so I think they feel very affirmed. They want copies, and Diana was gracious enough to give them each their portrait, and each will get a book.
Well, I love this phrase. I'm gonna read it out. Bringing the messages to life and completing the collage of recovery. Pretty heavy stuff. That seems to be, I'm not going to say beyond the pay grade of most artists, but in the course of art, what's that feeling like, and how has the process evolved during the project?
I feel that these portraits penetrate into the authentic, which is what Chip allows them to do, and they're allowing themselves to do. And that shows up in these images. They're very authentic. They're very beautiful. They're very quiet. And I think that although we're looking at an exterior, a person's face, maybe their jacket, we're really looking at them, thinking about their own lives, whether they've lost custody of their children, or maybe they've just started to have a job for the first time. Whatever point they're at in their recovery, I think it shows up very quietly and very nobly in these photographs that we collaboratively made. And there's just photographing all these men is the very opposite of what you think of when you think of photography of a portrait. Never once did a man do anything except perhaps change his shirt for the photograph. When they see their photograph, they embrace who they are. There's no criticism about how they look because they're so pleased that they're there and they're alive and they're sober. And it's been a really wonderful experience to see them react to their own images. They're looking at themselves and really liking it.
To the word collage, I really was hopeful when we did this project that you could start the book and finish the book and you would understand addiction as well as recovery, but it's not a narrative. It's really literally a scrapbook of faces and words. And when you put all of that together, that's what it's about. And it speaks so much more than an explanation about recovery.
They're all looking right at you. And I'm wondering about the trust. And how that comes into the process, what that's like in establishing that rapport, how important is that?
It's huge. It's enormous. I think the trust began when I was allowed into the room where Chip and the resident would have this conversation about really the depths of their addiction to where they are now, to where they hope to be. So I was able to be in that room listening to what is a very intimate and painful and beautiful. I mean, hope is very beautiful, but you really are a bit fragile when you're expressing it directly. I was allowed in that room, so right away the trust was there that they let me in, Chip let me in, and I could take that story, hold it close to my heart, really, and then go out and try to photograph that. And we would say, look into the lens and think about your son. Or think about how you enjoy the rain. Or think about who you are. And so they would stay in it. It's very focused, as you've just described, and I appreciate that you see that. But we help them stay directly in that moment and tell it to the lens, basically tell their story to the lens.
The eyes tell so much, and I'm just going to reference a few here. This photograph of Anthony, just the pose, the way he's holding his hands in front and the way he's staring right at the lens, as you mentioned there, makes me, as an observer, curious to know what's going on in his mind. Tell me a little bit about his story.
Well, you look at a picture, but then once you hear these words, you go back to the picture and you spend more time. And you're going to watch that dance between all of these because, yes, it's a picture of Anthony. And if you look at it, there's a confidence in his eyes and all of that. But he's also sitting right in front of a door. And here's what we've used from his interview. My bottom took me to my hands and knees, literally, begging God to help me. When all the furniture in my house was gone and nobody was around, I said, okay, let's do this. I was scared to release what had held me bondage for so long. It was eating me alive, and I used drugs to not think about it. I asked God why he let the things happen to me that had happened to me, and I was filled with anger. But I'm now working on changing things, trying to change my anger into forgiveness, so my past stops eating me alive. It feels like a weight has been lifted. Now I have sympathy for others. I can forgive others and not hold stuff in. I used to let people walk all over me like a doormat. I don't let them do that anymore. Now my best day is waking up in the morning and not having the physical urge to get dope or drink. I know it sounds so stupid, but it's true. And I thank God for that.
Looking at Anthony, he's got a boyish face, but the eyes look like a man twice his age. I mean, he's an old soul, I guess, in the sense. Do you perceive that in him, seeing him up close?
Anthony is very young. It's kind of startling when you first see him. And he's a slight man, too. He's not very large. But when he was talking about being a doormat, we thought, well, let's put him up against a door where definitely no one can get past him. So we were also working symbolically and metaphorically with each setting, as subtle as they are. And I, when I took this photograph, was down on the ground looking up at him. So he had the power because he was above me. That's an important decision I made with the point of view for this particular photograph because he's in charge. He's the one who can say if I'm in or I'm not in. And so I think you see that kind of almost a severity in his stance where he's like, I'm here. I'm looking right at you.
Yeah, it really comes across. The photograph of Don just below that, I was struck by the hands, the slightly distorted. And yet on this, the railing of the stairs there, as if on a rail of a train, you know, and that juxtaposition of the kind of distortion with the straight line.
And remember, it's a 12-step process. He's on stairs. And there's a railing on which to hold. Yeah. All of that is not lost to anyone in recovery, because that's what it's all about.
Francis is a photograph that just says so much for me, that the look in the eyes of... Okay, I'm going to trust you here, but there's a lot on the line there.
There is, and so many of these people have histories of not trust. They have had parents that have done shameful things to them. I mean, a lot of these guys have been through a great deal that has given them ample reason not to trust anyone or this world. And one of the great miracles of what happens while they're at Prodigals, and certainly during this project, is they walked into the room unsure who this person was taking their picture, and then I used the interview to calm them down and make them realize that they were safe. And suddenly they're realizing that, one, they can trust us, but they can also trust this world again, and that is real recovery.
Multimedia artist Diana Green and Prodigals community chaplain Chip Bristol. Their exhibition, Finding Home, Portraits of Courage, opens Monday afternoon, July 8th at 5:30 at the Winston-Salem Central Library, and it'll remain on display through September 30th. There'll be a free reception on August 28th from 5:30 to 7, and you'll find links to portraits and a personal essay from Finding Home on our website, wfdd.org. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from the short break, we'll get inside the mind of one of today's leading singer-songwriters. Spin Magazine calls her an artist you must hear now. And who are we to disagree? Fresh off the road with the great Bonnie Raitt, Winston-Salem native Sarah Siskind shares her musical gifts with us next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Singer-songwriter Sarah Siskind was born and raised in Winston-Salem. At 4 years old, she was singing and playing piano. She wrote her first songs by the age of 11, and when she was 14, she'd already completed her first album. After making a big name for herself in the highly competitive world of Nashville, honing her craft and writing songs recorded by the likes of Alison Krauss and Justin Vernon, Sarah's moved closer to home. The now Virginia-based singer-songwriter recently brought her unique voice to the Triad with a performance at the New Song Concert Series at Hanesbrands Theater in downtown Winston-Salem. While her music transcends category, it's a blend of the traditional and modern. Today we'll be sampling from her newly released EP, In the Mountains, and her CD, Novel. And on Tuesday, July 16th, Sarah's debut album, titled Covered, will be re-released. Amy Grant, Bonnie Raitt, and Spin Magazine give it a big thumbs up. And if you love hearing beautiful Appalachian music carried to new and exciting places, chances are you'll like it too. We're sampling from the title track right now.
Where do you go when you are feeling expired?
Sarah spoke with me by phone from her home in Virginia.
When I sing any song, whether it be for an intimate gathering or for a large theater, I think, you know, I have to go back to the state I was in when I wrote the song and reconnect to the story that it's about. And that's something that's really, I think, powerful about original music. You know, folks that write their own songs is that they created the story that the song is about. So when they perform it, it's as close to them, more close to them than anyone else. And so that's what I do. Each song is sort of like a play or a moment in time that I created when I wrote the song. So during performance, I just transport back to that moment. And quite a few of the songs are sad and on the intense side, but, you know, each song was written for a reason as far as, you know, I'm concerned as the writer. I mean, every song comes out either from an experience or from, you know, watching a friend go through something or a family member go through something. I've written a lot of songs about people who are close to me or people that I care about. I transport back to that story when I sing the song.
Is that transporting back difficult ever? And how does it morph over or evolve over time?
Yeah, it can be difficult. I think with Lovin's for Fools, that's a good song to point out as far as a song that I wrote a while ago that is still, you know, floating around in the universe. I had that song come out on an album, oh, I can't even remember now, I think it was 2004, an album called Studio Living Room, and it was a sad breakup song and about parting ways and other things, you know, just a lot of things that I think everyone can relate to. And even though songs can be sad when I write them, they also can be healing for me. But I had someone discover that song, Justin Vernon, who is Bon Iver, and he took that song and started performing it in his shows with Bon Iver. And then they blew up and became a very popular band. And that song has taken a life, you know, taken on a life of its own because he introduced it to so many people. And I get requested to sing that song all the time now, mostly because Justin sang it with Bon Iver. And it's interesting, even though the song itself is pretty heartbreaking, I enjoy singing it now because it has really, I've just heard so many stories from his fans who have found me, who have told me how much the song has meant to them and that it's been a healing story for them. I had a couple come to a show of mine once and they had the lyrics tattooed on their arm, and that was probably the craziest thing that anyone's ever done so far with one of my songs. But so now, when you ask about it evolving over time, it brings me joy to sing it because so many people have been moved by it. So it's really interesting how it has sort of a double meaning, and quite a few of my songs do that.
Well, go on and love her forever. I will not tell her you told me to. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Loving's for fools.
You just mentioned Justin Vernon, and I wanted to point out for listeners that, I mean, singer-songwriters like Alison Krauss have recorded a couple of your songs, Randy Travis another. For anyone who's written music and tried to break into the scene, that's an amazing achievement. I'm wondering, could you put that in perspective and being in the Nashville scene and cutting through like that?
Oh, I still pinch myself every day. I'm extremely, extremely grateful that my songs made their way to the ears of folks like Allison and Justin. I spent 14 years in Nashville, and I met people every day who had just moved there. I mean, it you know, trying to be in the music business and either write a hit song or become a star singer. I mean, it's just infiltrated with that, you know, activity of folks coming to be heard. And, you know, what's really magical about how it happened for me is that I wasn't pursuing the goal of getting my songs recorded by other people. I had only lived in Nashville for a couple of years when Allison heard me, and I was still getting my feet wet and meeting musicians, and you know, I was still discovering who I was as an artist, because I'd written so many songs, but they were across so many genres that as an artist, I was still trying to decide exactly what sound I had and all these things. So I just played a lot of shows. That's what I did. I did a lot of writers' nights and a lot of concerts, and it all unfolded organically that a friend of a friend heard me sing at a club in Nashville, and she was a great close friend of Allison's, and she heard me sing and just thought Allison should hear me, and she came up to me afterwards and asked if she could give some of my songs to Allison, and of course I said yes, and that's how it happened. And once Allison recorded one of my songs, things just sort of snowballed from there, and it was because of that song that I built my career on, because of it happening. It wasn't the other way around. You know, I'm very lucky that it happened that way, but it's also, to this day, sometimes when I'm pushing myself, you know, or being hard on myself because I'm not maybe achieving something that I want to achieve, I remind myself I landed in this spot organically because I was doing what I loved, and I wasn't doing it for the wrong reason. I was writing songs, and I was playing my songs for people. And really, that was all that I was doing at the time. And because I was doing what I needed to do, the stars aligned, and that path was opened to me to be able to make a career out of it. And here I am. Gosh, it's been at least 10 years, maybe 12 years now, I've been doing this for a living. And like I said, I pinch myself every day that I'm able to do it.
You know, when I hear a song, like, I'm going to give another example, Sarah, Falling Stars, I'm thinking of the line, I thought I could do it all better on my own, burn it down and build it back up. For me, as a listener and someone who appreciates, as anyone, I mean, as I'm a music lover, I hear just simple, direct, clear writing. And I'm wondering what sort of feedback you got from someone like Allison about your writing, or what struck her particularly, or Randy Travis?
Well, Allison has just been so wonderful to me, and I think she's said some things to me along the same lines of what you just said, that I am, lyrically, I tend to not use very much fluff, and I just cut right to the core of what I'm trying to sing about. I mean, I still like to be poetic, but when I sit down to write a song, if I can help it, I really try and clear my mind and really honor the song and the story that I want to tell and not think of anything else as far as how would this be perceived or what should I say here. And I try and silence that voice and really just trust that if I'm sitting down to write a song about something, that it's a story that I need to tell. And that method has really worked well for me, and I think that it creates a type of honesty in my writing. I thought I could make it better on my own. Everything in the backseat. I thought I could make it there. Head of the storm, no perils I would need, but the road was longer, the night was darker, and I felt falling like a storm. I guess that's all we really ever are, falling storm. What's
it like being on the road with Bonnie Raitt?
Oh, it's just unlike anything else in the world. Some of the best days and nights of my life. I was 6 months pregnant on that tour, so I it was surreal. You know, I was dealing with being pregnant and all the emotions and, you know, insomnia and all the things that go with that, on top of being with one of my heroes every day and getting to go out and actually sing some with her on stage. I hardly have words to explain what a gem she is. She's a true artist and a true entertainer, performer, singer, but the way that she treats people on the road, not just people she knows, but fans, people she doesn't know. She just has respect for people and is so kind. And I really, really learned a lot from being on the road with her. Huge thrill. I've been too long at the fair.
And Lord, I just can't stand it anymore. Did you grow up in Winston-Salem, or what time did you spend in this
I did. You born grew and up raised.
In, how about that?
Yeah.
What does it give you kind of in terms of your worldview on music, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely, I feel like I've come full circle. You know, moving back to this part of the country, I'm in Central Virginia now, and I'm just about 3 hours due north, northeast of Winston now. So, gosh, I think, you know, it's common with anybody who grows up somewhere and just wants to move away and then they move away and then they appreciate all the things that were there. And so I definitely, now that I'm an adult, I think back on all the wonderful musical things that happened in the Winston-Salem area, just there in the state of North Carolina. You know, my parents, they had a bluegrass band. They also played Celtic music. But they took me to bluegrass festivals, fiddling conventions, and, you know, I grew up listening to WFDD, and when I was 14 years old, I played there with Doc Watson and Maya Angelou, one of my best memories. So I'm very partial to WFDD.
Oh, what a great memory that is. Was that back in the Paul Brown days?
Yes, it was.
From all across.
He was a good friend of my parents. So.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we'll look forward to welcoming you back home when you get here. And thanks so much, Sarah. Not a sparrow
out of sight.
Singer-songwriter and Winston-Salem native Sarah Siskin. On Tuesday, July 16th, Sarah's debut album titled Covered will be re-released. You'll find links to that recording along with her newly released EP, In the Mountains, and her CD, Novel, on our website, WFDD.org. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And coming up after this short break, I'll do my darndest to make sure you don't get overwhelmed by this year's massive music festival offerings here in the Triad. Don't worry, App State's Megan Stage will hold our hands all the way through an Appalachian Summer Festival 2013. And none other than Maestro Gerard Schwartz is here to maintain a steady tempo for us at this year's Eastern Music Festival next after this break. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. An Appalachian Summer Festival 2013 kicks off July 5th and runs through August 1st on the App State campus in Boone with an exciting and diverse mix of music, dance, theater, visual arts, and film. For nearly a decade, the festival has been named one of the top 20 events in the Southeast by the Southeast Tourism Society. App State Official of Cultural Affairs Marketing Manager Megan Stage is now in her fourth year managing the festival. She provided this sneak preview of AppFest 2013, beginning with one of this year's headline musical performers, the band Perry.
Lord, make me a rainbow, I'll shine down on my mind.
They're so dynamic, and they're so in right now. They're over everything. Every time I turn on my TV, I see them. Every time I turn on my radio, I hear them. They are an incredible, talented group. They are siblings, and I think that helps them, really. They have such a jive on stage, and it's so powerful, and they are a country band, but sometimes when you're watching them live, you feel like you're at a rock concert, so we're real excited to have them come and rock out our stadium.
If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down.
Idina Menzel, today's Queen of Broadway, follows, and you're diving right into that great mix of styles for the festival.
We have wanted her for many years, and so we are so fortunate to bring her this year. And she's actually opening the Schaefer Center for the Performing Arts. We have undergone a renovation this year of our main performance hall. It used to be Farthing Auditorium, and now it's the Schaefer Center for the Performing Arts. And she will be opening that renovated facility, and there's not one artist that can do it like she can. She's going to be performing with the Eastern Festival Orchestra, backing up her vocals. So it's going to be, you know, just an incredible evening. Such a powerful voice, and it's going to be fantastic.
Kiss me goodbye, I'm divine.
And then we get the more reflective Rare Acoustic Show with Lyle Lovett, and just a consummate performer.
Yeah, Lyle Lovett is, you know, an iconic singer-songwriter, really more of a storyteller, I think, in his music. And you can really hear that in some of the songs that he writes and how he performs. He's very relatable, and I think this kind of performance kind of strips him down. And he has, you know, his backup acoustic group. So it's going to be a real intimate evening towards the end of the festival. We have scattered these performances all over, but the popular series events are really diverse, and it's going to be a lot of fun. His career has spanned, you know, 40 years, and it's pretty impressive who he's worked with, and those tickets are selling pretty fast for that one as well.
I'll bet they are. And speaking of spanning 40 years, we got 40 years and then some with Boz Scaggs, from the great Steve Miller Band to superstardom, and boy, he's got a sound, his own style.
His voice is so recognizable, and he has really tapped in. He's one of those artists that you have seen him really kind of cover every form and style of music, and he somehow has tapped into all of that. He's done jazz, he's done R&B and soul, he's done some, you know, more folky sounding music as well, and so he really knows how to bridge that gap between these completely different forms of music and create this style. And he's got a new album out as well. It's called Memphis. It's got some great new tracks, but then he also does some covers of some other songs like Karina Karina and some really great songs as well. And, you know, he's got great hits from over the years. So he's another one that we're just so excited and fortunate to have. He really rounds out the popular series.
Eyes like fire in the night.
Seems like just about every artist you've got lined up here has great hits and then some. And this, you probably talk about your power trio, and I'm talking about the Mary Chapin Carpenter behind the tune Passionate Kisses, and paired up Sean Colvin, Sonny Came Home, and then who could forget Luca? I mean, Suzanne Vega. And
right.
What a great group of just acclaimed songwriters and evidently longtime friends.
They are, yeah. Actually, Mary Chapin Carpenter and Sean Colvin are on a tour right now. And so we heard about the tour, and they together are so dynamic because they do have that, I think, intimate friendship that they've had for years. And their music sounds so good together, and I actually would have never put them together. But it makes perfect sense now that I have listened to them perform together. I've, you know, watched a bunch of videos, and you can see, and they just jive so well together, and their careers are so impressive, and they're really strong songwriters as well. And then we have the opportunity for this one time only. It doesn't happen anywhere else. Suzanne Vega is going to be joining them as a special guest, and that's just the perfect compliment. And having these three powerful women singer-songwriters that have just, you know, really influenced and have been a huge influence on a lot of different artists, and you can hear that in their music as well. So it's really exciting to have to finish the festival with that sort of power.
My name is Luca. I live on the second floor.
Speaking of power, you get the power of the entire orchestra, and that with a longtime collaboration with the Eastern Music Festival and the Eastern Festival Orchestra, in this case with one of the world's greatest pianists, and Andre Watts performing.
Yes, Andre Watts is coming as well. I think we do have such a great relationship with the Eastern Festival Orchestra in Greensboro. Gerard Schwartz is, you know, such a fantastic conductor and partner for us. He helps us out in so many different ways. But he is bringing Andre Watts, but they'll also be having Julian Schwartz, who is Gerard Schwartz's son, doing a solo, as well as the winner of last year's Rosenschaffel Young Artist Competition, which we had last year. It's been its third year coming up. But the winner of that competition, that was a festival competition, is actually performing with Gerard and Andre and Julian. And his name is also Julian. His name is Julian Rose. He is he plays the flute. And so it's an incredible performance. It's very diverse, and Andre Watts is, you know, truly just one of the best pianists of all time, I think. I know it's a biased opinion, but it's going to be a fantastic, unforgettable performance.
And we should point out that Julian Schwartz, one of the great young up-and-coming cellists in the world, and a solo career all his own.
Right, yes. I think about him like, oh, that's such a famous name to be under your father, but he really is creating his own path and creating his own career for himself, with or without the name of his father, and he's very impressive, and the piece that he's going to be doing is going to sound great, so we're very excited.
App State Office of Cultural Affairs Marketing Manager Megan Stage with just a small sampling of this year's musical performers at an Appalachian summer festival. This is Megan's fourth year managing the festival, and she says this is their best ever, with an exciting and diverse mix of music, dance, theater, visual arts, and film. AppFest 2013 will run the entire month of July through August 1st on the App State campus. You'll find links to the complete schedule at WFDD.org. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend, by the way. I'm David Ford, glad to be along with you today. And I was also glad to get in touch with Maestro Gerard Schwartz last week, the legendary conductor, former principal trumpeter with the New York Philharmonic, composer and mostly Mozart Festival director for many years, has led the Eastern Music Festival since 2007. EMF 2013 in Greensboro runs from June 24th to July 27th, and this year's lineup of world-renowned performers is arguably the most incredible in the festival's 52-year history. Violinist Joshua Bell, pianist Andre Watts, and cellist Lynn Harrell are just a few of the many wonderful guest artists performing concerts with the festival orchestra and chamber music, as well as teaching the talented EMF students. Since taking the reins as artistic director at EMF, Jerry has expanded the festival's audiences to the largest in its history, while enhancing education and programming to include a composer in residence and three new concert series. He's also been responsible for bringing regular premieres of new works to EMF each season by some of this country's greatest living composers. He spoke with me recently by phone from his home in New York. I began by asking him what's been behind the festival's amazing success.
Well, first of all, we have a great festival orchestra. So the orchestra comes from members of orchestras from all over the country, and Canada as well. We have phenomenal students. And what happens at Eastern that's really, I think, maybe more interesting than most places is that all of the faculty members, all of the members of the orchestra, they all teach at the school, which means that everyone has two or three students, and that's all. And they focus on those students, and the students get a tremendous amount of attention. The faculty, you know, support their kids, but the kids come to the concert supporting their teachers. We have three orchestra concerts a week, all in this fantastic concert hall, Dana Auditorium at Guilford College. Now, Dana has great acoustics. It's a gorgeous-sounding hall. It also is air-conditioned, and it's also indoors. Now, you know, everybody likes outdoor concerts, and I know we do a few of those during the summer, but basically, to hear music in a good acoustical environment without bugs, without noise of sirens, is the way it should be, and that's what we do. Then we also do two chamber music concerts a week. We also do a piano recital concert every week, and then we have special events. So on Wednesday nights, we do, you know, a Bach concert or a Vivaldi concert. I mean, it's just chock full. So I have friends coming down for the summer who go to concerts every night of the week. So we have a concert every night of the week. Plus, we have fringe. We have things that are not quite classical and not really doesn't fit into the classical milieu, but brings people to downtown and more interesting, popular events. I mean, for us and for me, it's, I would say for just about all of us that go there, it's the high point of the year. 5 weeks of intense music making with dear friends and a wonderful atmosphere with great kids, a great audience. As you can tell from my talking about it, it's a very exciting, fun, thrilling time for all of us.
And Jerry, we haven't even spoken about some of a few fairly recognized names that will be coming as part of the guest soloists. You'll be enjoying EMF this summer. And I should let listeners know that, I mean, the roster of world-renowned guest artists expanded right when you got there, really, as director in 2007, and it's continued to grow, beginning with, well, arguably one of his generation's greatest violinists, Joshua Bell. What strikes you most about Josh's playing, just off the top?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. He's a great musician, a great violinist, a great communicator, and he's a serious musician. And I first worked with Josh when he was, I think, 16, and he was, you know, he grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, where I think his parents taught at the university, and he studied there then. And this kid was an extraordinarily talented kid at the age of 16. I mean, you could tell that there's something very special about his playing. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate into a big career. In his case, though, he grew artistically, he grew as a violinist, and then his passion and involvement with the music is paramount, and his communicative ability with the audience is extraordinary. And that's what it takes to make a career like that. And he's a dear friend of mine for many years, obviously, and having him come to open our season is just dynamite. He's playing Mendelssohn Concerto, with obviously very traditional work, but there's nothing wrong with that. It's a great, great work, which he plays beautifully. And what we also try to do with most of our guest artists, you know, as you know, Andre Watts and playing the Grieg Concerto, and Lynn Harrell playing the Dvorak Concerto, and so forth, we try to get them to be involved with our chamber music concerts as well, and also to give classes to our students. So we really try to, as much as possible, have these great artists be part of the festival, not just run through town for a day, you know what I mean.
And that's a huge part of the festival, and audiences and the students obviously get an enormous amount out of that sort of interaction. Almost the entire string section is represented this year through guest soloists, guest artists, and longtime Cleveland Orchestra violist Robert Vernon's a huge addition. You can't leave that section with a tradition dating back to George Zell and beyond without being an exceptional orchestral player. Well, but he's also a champion of chamber music as well.
He is, and Bob is one of the most important viola teachers in the world. I know he teaches at Juilliard. He probably teaches at Cleveland Institute also. I'm not sure. But
he does.
I know he teaches at Juilliard because I see him there once in a while. He's a great violist. He's a great orchestral violist. He's a great chamber music player. He's a great soloist. I mean, when you think about the viola, it's not like the violin where there are a lot of soloists. On the viola, there aren't a lot. Most of the viola soloists come from the orchestra, and like Bob. And so what we try to do is, yes, we bring in the superstars like, you know, Andre and Josh Bell, but we also bring in the stars of the orchestra world, like Mark Kossauer, who's also the first cello in Cleveland, and Bob Vernon, because that's an important part of our world. I mean, we're an orchestra place. We have three orchestras, and most of the kids will not be musicians. Music will be part of their lives. Very gifted kids, really, like something like 8% of them become musicians. We're not trying to train musicians. We're trying to train well-rounded, wonderful, contributing citizens, and some of them will become musicians. The ones who become musicians, most of them, if they're lucky, will get to play in an orchestra. So we have a strong emphasis on orchestral playing, and therefore we bring in the great soloists, but, you know, like Lynn Harrell, we also bring in a great orchestral player like Mark Kossauer or Bob Vernon to coach our kids, to give them their insights, to talk about the orchestral life, and to participate in chamber music and solo playing with us. So it's, I think, a wonderful combination, and that's what we try to do every year.
And the king of the concert stage is always well represented at EMF as well. This year, no exception, with two of today's giants. Beginning, you mentioned Andre Watts.
One of the great sensations of all the years that Bernstein did the Young People's Concerts was when he had Andre Watts playing Liszt Concerto with him. I think Andre was 16 when he did. And it catapulted him to international fame. Again, it doesn't always do that. You can have some great pianist come and play, and then everyone says, oh, isn't it wonderful? He's fantastic. And then you move on. But Andre had something extraordinary then, as he does now. Like Josh Bell, he's a very serious, thoughtful musician, a wonderful human being who comes to help. He comes, he talks to the kids, he plays with them, and he's just one of the more extraordinary human beings. Everybody has their own history. Lynn Harrell, his is interesting too, because at a very young age, as a teenager, I think, he became the principal cello of the Cleveland Orchestra with George Zell. And so his first step as a professional musician was playing in Cleveland when he was basically very young and somewhat green, and that was Zell's way. Zell loved to attract and mold young musicians, and I think if you talk to Lynn, he would say that one of his greatest influences in his performing career has been George Zell. So everybody has their little story to tell.
This season coming up, what are you looking forward to? Maybe a highlight or two from your mind, either program or an aspect of the festival that you're really looking forward to this season.
Well, I guess it's always the same for me. I just love the music. I love the programs. I love the old ones, you know, the Brahms Fourth and the Scheherazade Rimsky Korsakov, but I also love doing the new works. I love working with the great artists, and I love working with all these wonderful musicians in the professional orchestra. I'm also doing something a little bit unusual this year. I'm doing one concert, which I'm looking forward to very much. The day after the Josh Bell concert, which is on a Friday, on Saturday, Bill Wolfram, one of the great pianists, American pianists, playing before the public today, is on our faculty. And he's going to do this first, third, and fourth Beethoven concertos on one concert on that Saturday night, which I'll conduct. But what's also interesting about it is that we'll have three different orchestras play. One orchestra, one of the student orchestras, will play the first concerto. One of the student orchestras will play the third concerto. And the festival orchestra, the faculty orchestra, will play the fourth concerto. So on one Saturday night, one pianist, one conductor, three orchestras. I think, I don't know if this has ever happened in history either. So I'm really excited about that event as well. We just can't wait to get started.
Eastern Music Festival Artistic Director Gerard Schwartz. EMF 2013 is up and running, and you'll find links to the complete performance schedule with concerts by pianist Andre Watts, violinist Joshua Bell, cellist Lynn Hirrell, and many others at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Kathleen Coker. You'll find archived episodes of Triad Arts Weekend and podcasts at WFDD.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.